Welcome to the Seamus Heaney Centre podcast. In recent episodes, we've been hearing from some of our students in a series of pilot programmes, each a little different to reflect the range of writing and conversations about writing that go on in the centre. In this episode, we join Sharon Dempsey, Niamh McCann and Emma Devlin as they catch up to discuss progress of their PhDs and share some works in progress. This is The Edit.
Hi and welcome back to The Edit. Over the duration of our series of episodes, we hope to demystify the creative process, to discuss what we're working on and how we're navigating our academic work while creating new fiction. I'm Sharon Dempsey and I'm a crime writer.
My name is Niamh McCann and I'm doing a PhD in screenwriting and writing a sci-fi screenplay.
I'm Emma Devlin. I'm writing a series of short stories set in the Anthropocene.
Good to be back and see everybody here again. What have we all been getting up to this week? Emma, you had some very good news actually with the Galley Bigger Prize longlisting. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, well, that was such a whirlwind. I think, so the Galley Bigger Press, they're a publishing house based in, oh no, I can't remember now off the top of my head where they're based, but they're based in England anyway. And I've always been a huge fan of their output. So they're the ones that publish Ducks Newburyport. They've also got loads of really cool other books like Lucia and Wrestliana by Toby Litt. And so whenever this came along, they had really good, like, they were just a really generous prize, right? They had a very long word count, 6,000 words, which you never find in short story competitions. It's usually like 2,500 or something like that. So I thought, like, I have to enter this. And I submitted it. And I'll admit to you that I wrote it within 2 days for the deadline. And fired it off and kind of just forgot about it, like, nobody, that's not, no they're not gonna pick that. But they chose it for the long list, and it was the most bizarre feeling because they announced it live author by author on Twitter, and I was sitting there like, oh my god. And then my name came up and it's just the most surreal thing seeing my work up there along with all of these other amazing writers. And they were really generous again whenever they announced the long list, because they published everyone's story on their website. Mm-hmm. So that gave everyone a chance to have their work read and be sort of seen by readership, which I thought was wonderful, because again, you don't really get that level of generosity from competition sometimes. There's no place to put the stories. Now, sadly, I didn't make the shortlist and I didn't win it, but I think that the shortlist included one of my favorite stories of that list. Again, I just can't remember the name off the top of my head now, but it's really really well worth checking out that list, because there's some brilliant pieces of work on it.
So what does that sort of validation do for you as a creative? Does it sort of give you that energy to keep going?
It is energy. Yeah, because it just gives you that kind of sense of, okay, somebody else who I've never met before, I don't know them, has read my work and they thought it was good enough to make it this far. And it is such a validating experience, I think, because I think it can be a lonely old slog whenever you're writing your own work, and you do get to share it with, you know, your supervisors, or maybe with one or two readers that you might have or whatever, but it can be a bit lonely and you feel like, am I barking up the wrong tree here, you know? And having somebody completely outside your circle reading something and saying, yes, we want that on the long list or short list or whatever, is such a, it can give you that boost that you need to kind of think, okay, I am on the right track. You know, this is the right thing that I'm doing, and I can keep going now. It is nice to get something like that once in a while.
That's brilliant. It's funny because my book was published a fortnight ago, and as part of that process, you're waiting to see what your peers are going to say about it. And Steve Kavanagh's hugely successful crime writer based in Northern Ireland, but he sets his books in New York. He's a legal sort of thriller writer. And he came out at the weekend and, you know, posted a picture of my book on Twitter and said it was an excellent slice of crime fiction. Go out and get it, blah, blah. And then somebody came along and tweeted beneath that it wasn't an appropriate day to be promoting a book about the abduction and murder of a woman, because of the whole Sarah Everard case, which was just horrific. So I went from feeling fantastic about getting that validation from a male peer to feeling, oh my goodness, what are people going to think about what I'm writing? So I felt I had to respond to that tweet. And immediately I went back and said, listen, you got to read the book and you'll understand then that, yes, you know, this is part of the debate, but the book doesn't promote misogyny. The book does not promote violence against women. And if anything, crime fiction is the place to explore those issues, you know, and to look at sort of police neglect of female victims and the societal treatment of working class women as well. So it was just strange to go from that moment of validation to almost having to defend myself for my work. Do you get
Twitter
that?
For you? The discourse can turn on you very, very quickly. And I think your response is just pitch perfect there, because like, you're absolutely right. You're not writing to take advantage of a real life event. You were writing this much in advance. You know what you're talking about, and you're writing with a sensitivity towards the way that you treat these topics. So yeah, like that's such a, I'm sorry that that happened, because you really should take heart in the fact that you're one of your peers did that in the first place. It's one of those things. It's an open forum for people to respond that way.
I know. And the guy that did tweet that, he probably was coming from a good place. You know, he probably felt, I got to call this out, but he didn't realize, you know, the context and stuff. And he has since said he'll go away and read the book now, you know, but
well, that's good. We'll see. Back open hearts and minds.
Well, exactly. But Niamh, what about you? How do you deal when you hit a wall or when things don't go well, you know, in life in general?
Yeah. So like, first of all, just congratulations to you both. Like, it's absolutely incredible. I can't wait to read your book, Sharon, and I read your short story, and it's incredible. So witty. And like, I love the structure of it. And like, the kind of breaks from the norm of like a structure of prose are so, so nice. And there's one line in it, actually, I don't know, I'm not going to say it because you might say it later, but it really made me laugh, and I've just been thinking about it all week. But yeah, so I'm going to be a bit more of a stick in the mud, I think, compared to you guys. So I'm going to talk a little bit about less about the progress or things that I've been doing, and a bit more about the complete evaporation of progress that I've kind of had last month, because I think we want this to be a very open and accurate snapshot of what it is like to do a creative PhD. And obviously, unfortunately, sometimes life does get in the way, and especially for a creative practice, which is so fueled by life and experience, sometimes maybe you do need to take a minute and take stock of what it's throwing at you, and sometimes it's not instantly synthesizable into work, so you need to take that minute. So obviously you guys know my grandmother fell ill, and then over the course of a couple of weeks died last month. So that was really, really hard, and I very heavily was emotionally supporting my mom, which I was incredibly grateful to do, but also is obviously very emotionally taxing for myself too. So yeah, it just meant I couldn't do any PhD work at all. I was meant to be doing a task for my PhD supervisor, so I couldn't do that. And it's just like coming to terms with that. And I found that I was actually okay with being derailed, and I was quite content to make that detour and be there for my mom and deal with my own emotions. But a huge contributing factor to that was just being open and honest with my supervisor. And I think that's the one thing I would take away, and just that I don't think I would have done before. Like, a past self wouldn't have done that. I wouldn't have trusted him to have, you know, taken that in a very amazing way and like given me the time, because people don't know to give you slack if you don't ask for it. And I think that's the main thing. It's like, I don't know, it's like putting your indicators on when you're driving. You know, it's not a burden on people. It's just letting people know that you're kind of switching lanes. So yeah, that was the kind of practical element of it. But also, I wanted to, the time itself, because I'm a person who thinks very deeply about emotions and things. And I think emotions are great. Like sadness or times of happiness are fantastic, but they're very good for creativity, but not so good for productivity and action sometimes. So that paradox is really interesting, and I try to leave myself little nearly like booster packages along the way of emotions so that I can kind of pick them back up whenever I'm ready to make work again. So that's what I've been kind of trying to do, and that's the only thing I've been able to do the last month.
I think it's really interesting what you've said, Niamh, about, you know, taking that time. I think, you know, when we're less experienced, sometimes there's a compulsion to write through it, and that doesn't always, you know, produce the best work or be the best thing for us emotionally. You know, we had Marion Keyes give a masterclass at the Seamus Heaney Centre last week, and she talked about putting the bucket down to an empty well. You're not going to pull water up. And I think there is that sense that you need to protect yourself sometimes and take time to heal or just deal with life, you know?
Yeah, and I think maybe it comes a little bit with age maybe, or you've got a better perspective on time, where it's like, if I look after myself for a month, I'm going to do so much better this year, rather than the immediacy of being like, I have to do this thing right now and not take care of myself and then down the line, you know, be worse off for it. And it's just that kind of perspective of taking a step back and seeing time as a longer scaled progression rather than just the right now, which is hard to do.
It's fake.
I think that you phrased it really well there. When you say like it's putting the indicators on and changing lanes, because you're still moving forward. You know, your pace is just different from the people around you, and that they make way for you. You know what I mean? So like that's a really good, neat way of kind of summing up the way it works, I think.
I often think as well, when I'm teaching creative writing, I often talk about the beats in a scene that we're all aware of when we're watching drama on television more than anything, but the peaks and the troughs. And if you sort of map that out, it's basically what you would see on a heart monitor, you know, and it's up and down. And it's when we're flatlining that we're not progressing, you know, it's those highs and lows that create a movement forward, that give the story the engine and give us the engine that keeps us going as creatives. Do you feel that, Niamh, or are you just still in the depths of, you know, dealing with grief?
I'm definitely going through little peaks now, I think, where I'm able to kind of draw from any kind of fragments or streams of consciousness that I tried to write down during that time. And I am I always have worked from sketchbooks and from notebooks and things like that. I think my practice in art college really gave me that for the rest of my life, which is great. And I'll always just put things down on paper, no matter how insignificant they might seem. Because it's just those little moments that you can then draw from later on that you would have you would never have remembered because you were so emotional at the time, I think, and everything's so real when you're going through it. And then just leaving yourself those little markers so you can go back to that emotion if you want to and if you're ready to, I think is really important, because obviously you don't want to be overwhelmed by thinking about it all the time. But just little details, trying to get them down, and then going back to them. That's the only work I've been able to do, is taking some of those bits and pieces and trying to translate them into poems, which I've never done before and I've always wanted to do. And it seemed like the right time. And the funeral and everything was in like this incredible, like, you know, poetic area of beauty where I'm from, Limavady, up the mountain where my granny was from. And it seemed like the right thing to do with all those memories and all that emotion. So that's what I've been working on, which is fun because it's new and it's completely unrelated to my PhD. I've never done poetry before and I don't think I'm very good at it, but I really enjoy it. And I think that's a little break from the kind of critical work that I was having to do and the screenwriting that I was trying to make myself do that just wasn't happening at all.
But I think it's great that you found a vehicle really to put all that emotion and to work through that. And as creatives, I don't think we can ever understand what we're going through until we've distilled it into something else almost, you know. There's something healing in doing the work. And if poetry is your vehicle for that at the minute, then just use it and go with it.
Definitely. And it's kind of laying foundations for screenwriting anyway, I think, because I'm a visual person, I think visually, so that'll all be there to draw from and just kind of, as you say, distill it into maybe more work. Maybe the poetry won't be the work, it will be the kind of structure for later work, I think, which is good to do whenever you're hitting a wall. You're just leaving yourself something for when you come back to it.
Exactly. Emma, how do you feel about the critical versus the creative? You know, because Niamh was saying about, you know, going from one extreme of it almost to the other, you know, they seem as if they're running parallel. Is that hard for you?
At times it feels like I'm working on two very separate projects and I can't seem to find the bridge between them. I think it's because they're evolving at different paces. So what I initially set off to do with the critical is slightly different from what I'm finding myself doing now, whilst the creative kind of hasn't strayed too far yet, although I think some parts of it are starting to change from my initial idea. So it feels like I'm kind of got two dogs and two leads. One of them's going one way and one of them's going the other, and I'm kind of like trying to go forward, like, no, please. And as a result, I kind of fell behind with my critical because I had kind of gone down this rabbit hole and I was trying to catch up on some reading for some ideas I'd been having. So I kind of fallen behind a little bit on that, and equally with my creative as well, if I'm honest. But I'm catching up now, I'm picking up the pace.
That's it. It's never going to go, you know, bang on at the right time, and we've got to just go with that. You know, I feel sometimes that the creative and the critical should be in dialogue with each other, but most of the time they're like a bickering old couple and neither really agrees with the other or knows what the other needs from them, you know. So that's how I'm sort of finding that I'm sort of, on one hand, the critical is really supporting what the creative does and vice versa, but it's just trying to get your head around both at the same time is the problem. You know, if you live in one for a while, you're okay, and then you move to the other, but it's when that sort of synergy needs to happen that it's difficult. You know, I mean, I have sent my supervisors about a third of my critical, and I'm waiting for them to come back with notes. So everything has sort of halted because I think, well, there's no point going anywhere with this until I know what they feel about it. So it's a strange process, isn't it? Getting feedback as you go along with it as well.
I think as well, the critical tends to, like, it tugs you in all kind of different directions. So it's really hard to know if you're going in the right direction. And as you said, the time that you're waiting for feedback, you do want to stop, because you know that if you keep going, you will be in a different place by the time you get the feedback. And then it's like, what do I do with feedback when I've already moved on from there? And definitely what you were saying, Emma, with them moving at two different paces, because I think we like to think that the creative part just kind of flows out of us and is quite organic. Whereas for me anyway, the critical is a bit of a slog and it's very slow and it kind of clunks along, and the two definitely do move at different paces and are different beasts.
Very much so.
So how do we feel about sharing a bit of our creative and doing a bit of reading?
So scared. Yeah, I'm happy enough. I've got something I've been working on for what feels like a decade. So I'm happy to, like, share a bit of that. Get it out.
Put it out in the world, Emma.
So Sharon, what are you sharing? Are you going to share?
I'm going to share an extract of the novel that I'm writing as part of the PhD. But I just want to say at this point that, you know, because we're all in lockdown, we don't really get this opportunity for sort of group criticism, you know. And if any listeners fancy sending us something, we would happily do a show where we sort of look at somebody else's work rather than our own, and have that kind of dialogue emerge. You know, that I think that would be useful for other people too. What do you guys think?
Have them talk about their work here as well. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, definitely. Because I think, you know, even if we weren't in lockdown, I think PhD is that's the one thing I'm really, really missing, is that kind of group crit every week, every 2 weeks or whatever, seminars and workshops that you get in your undergrad and your masters that just help you you're constantly being raked across the coals, you know, and that's, it just becomes, you know, point, it's just easy then, you just keep doing it over and over again. So I think it's really good if we invite people on to do it.
Well, Emma,
not that we're going to rake them across the coals.
No, not at all.
No, absolutely not. We'll be kind.
Emma, do you want to read first then?
Yeah, okay. Let me just bring it up here. So this is a work in progress. It's provisionally called Welcome to Seatown, and I'll read just a short bit from it. And here goes. Welcome to Seatown. These are the things the sea knows. The king's house is far away down the coast, high up on a shelf of rock. He is alone there. Everyone else left when the erosion problem could no longer be ignored. Whole gardens disappeared. Property values sunk. The king's way of thinking hardly recognizes these things. He stays and he sits in the sliver of his garden to watch the waves bite on the rocks below. That, for him, is good value for money. Nothing grows up there apart from skimpy patches of grass, some pernicious weeds. They have names which the man, his son, can never remember. The door was locked. The lights were off. The king never turned his lights off. The house was visible at night from the man's house away on the other side of town. The sea knows these things. These things are important. The sea knows many things about the king and his family. It has been watching. The boy is 5, full of energy. He chirps about the wind, the sky, and the whales. This is the king's grandson. He is singing about something. He is asking about something. He is hanging off the man's hand. The man's thoughts are elsewhere. The man is the king's son. He is thinking, and the sea can sympathize with this, about the king. Some thoughts keep creeping through the man's head. Some fish make their own light. That's evolution for them in the dark. The king wrote him a letter, sort of. The man is still trying to make sense of it. The paper was shoved into his letterbox. The man had recognized the writing at once, had gone up and down the road looking for him. The king was already gone. That had been days ago. Them in the dark. The boy makes the man say the new words, which he does without thinking. Blubber, blowhole, baleen. They've been learning about the whales together. The boy loves the word blubber and says it over and over again. He squeezes its syllables together and stretches them apart, testing its strength. He belts the word out and it bounces down the street. Blubber. The man jumps. A dog starts barking. An angry sound from a hidden place. The king addressed the letter to the boy. This is for you and not your father. I'm writing it down so you'll know. I want to tell you about the thing I seen. Your father doesn't like this, but you must understand. It's Seatown. I haven't seen your father in a long time. I have not seen you since you were a baby. It's better maybe you read this and don't know me. The boy knows the king 3 stories. He enjoys hearing about the king. His list of favourite words includes Seatown. The man doesn't recall ever telling the boy about Seatown, but he must have done all the same. The boy makes his own sense out of it. The boy has a way of seeing the wheels everywhere. He points at shapes and shadows that might be them. Bulbous heads appear to him in patches of sunlight. He's disappointed that the man can't see them. This should be perfectly obvious, the boy's stance says. They're right there if you look properly. The man says that they're just shadows from buildings or vehicles or trees. Still, the boy keeps looking and finds a wheel, a shark's tooth, a blubber, a blowhole, a whale's tooth, a whale's brain, a seagull, a fish, another fish, a baby whale, a mummy whale, another whale. Seatown. 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 Sure, the man says. Okay, son. The wheels are a public event. There are people on the street corners shaking money boxes. Again, save the wheels, again. And other people on other corners with other money boxes. Save the wheels, save yourself. They pass a man who twirls with a sign in his hand that says, Crisis Wheel Hoax. He is pacing up and down like a preacher, and his voice lifts above the racket and delivers a series of rants about weaponized weather systems, weaponized oceans, weaponized deep sea consciousness, weaponized water cycles. There's someone not far away, and for him, it's the end of the world. The shit's at the fan, it's picnic time, it's bug out time. Save the wheels. Everyone shouts over everyone else, and the man and the boy make their way through the crossfire to get to the beach. People like the man and the boy can do nothing else except go to the wheels and spend time with them. The sea knows these things and is pleased.
There you go. So good. Thank you. I just love how the boy is making sense of the world through story, and that this sense of the sea having this deep sea consciousness and everything being at play within that, it just was amazing. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's absolutely gorgeous. I love that. To save the whales, for the love of God, save the whales.
Save them, save the whales.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's such an innocence in telling a story in that way, and yet the simplicity is there in front of all of us, you know, and we're not doing enough for our part. It works on so many levels.
Do you find it really freeing to write from the perspective of the sea like that, or is it more difficult?
I think before, when I first started this project, I think I would have said, oh, it's grand, it's easy. But the more I read about like the ethics around like anthropomorphism, like, you know, giving human characteristics to non-human things, the more I'm kind of like, oh, I don't know if I should be doing it this way. But what I have figured out is that I think it's a very nuanced debate, because we are, of course, writing for other humans. So it's like, it's trying to just, yeah. So I think it's a very fraught question. It's far more complicated than I initially would have kind of thought, and it's got a lot more morals and ethics wrapped up in it, I think, than I would have considered before.
Yeah, and it's very philosophical. Like, you know, you're like given subjectivity to the sea, you know, and like given it an outlook on the world, and like what does that mean for people's beliefs and, you know, spirituality and stuff like that's all wrapped up in it too.
Especially because I'm very aware that I'm a white Western woman writing my perspective of what the sea is, if you see what I mean, whereas there's so many different cultures and different belief systems around water and the sea that I'm kind of just aware that this is only a very small localized viewpoint that I've given the sea, really, even though I'm trying to write it from this kind of more universal sense. So I am aware of those things, and it's just something I'm kind of working on, trying to figure out a bit more.
I think sort of thinking about the sea as having agency in itself almost excuses all the arguments, you know, that agency is there in an energy and in motion, and it has impact on us. So I think you're allowed, therefore, to give your sort of impact onto the sea and superimpose almost that. You know, I don't know. I think you can defend it to the nth degree, and you probably will be called to, but that's fine, you know.
Yeah, oh, don't get me wrong. It's just things I think make it a richer kind of richer text. Whenever you kind of just are aware of these things and just are aware of your positioning of yourself when you write things like this. That's all I mean.
Yeah. Okay. Niamh, do you want to share your poem then? I think you were going to do some poetry today.
Yes, I'll try my best. I've never read any poetry before, so forgive me. And also, anybody who hears it might not think that it's a poem, because I don't know what a poem is, really.
It's a poem if you say it's a poem.
Yeah.
Don't worry.
So it's called Darling. Donna leaves first. She can't bear the waiting anymore. And her husband is outside. She kisses skin. Youngest of nine, she leaves silence behind her. With her fringe sticking to her forehead, she breaks a period that occupies a tear in my mind. Time is looping in that fissure. I had been staring at the table in the corner of the room. It held her photograph now. She had put a cigarette out on it last week. Mum gave her a white biro instead, and from Wednesday she didn't know the difference. The week before, I'd held her hand and said I loved her, and rubbed her feet and said I loved her. I hadn't expected an echo back. How could she, through swirling flies she'd seen on Tuesday or shiny objects on the windowsill that drew her hand to them? She had put a cigarette out on her bedside table. Mum gave her a white biro instead, and from Wednesday she didn't know the difference. She had a small green straw to drink from and demanded a tissue in her hand, but still tutted at it there. She laughed at all my sister's jangly bracelets, but Aoife was only wearing one, and it was plain. So she had put a cigarette out on her bedside table. Mum had given her a white biro instead, and from Wednesday she didn't know the difference. I wonder about the flies, the pen, the shiny things, the bracelet, the tissues, a kaleidoscope of nonsense objects, tripled, quadrupled, looping in her good eye, or was it her blind eye turned from her already, fragmenting and pulling the world into a semi-lucid theatre, a feedback loop, a private viewing, through all of her, through her everything, though, as she knows, somewhere, not her, the world continues. Love you too, darling. Look after yourself.
Oh, so beautiful.
Niamh, I love that. That was amazing.
Thank you very much.
Part lament, part eulogy, part just story of somebody's love, you know, so powerful. Thank you very much.
The way that you worked around, like with time, like the things like Wednesdays and Tuesdays and like objects and just making sense of things. It was just, yeah, it was brilliant.
I love that line, the terror in my mind, because we've all felt that at times, you know, where you just like the past and the present are colliding and that terror does happen. It feels physical almost.
Yeah, and if you think about it for long enough, you can put yourself there because it's still there, it's still looping in your mind, sort of.
And you know, and that sense of somebody being here and almost half gone already, and how we're sort of preparing them and ourselves for that. Yeah, it's just very powerful. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Oh, I feel bad now reading mine because it's just like.
Don't be daft.
I'll contextualize it a little bit. It's from a novel called After the Party, and hang on, I'll get it up here. And I suppose my problem with it at the minute is that it's told from the point of view of the mothers of boys, young men who've been accused of sexual assault, and my worry at the minute is that the mothers are becoming too masculine with their characterization, but then I'm sort of answering that to myself by saying that they themselves, the mothers, are product of this patriarchal society, which has allowed for sort of privilege and, you know, bad behavior, for another way of putting it, which is a ridiculous way of putting it actually, but that's the way these mothers would be contextualizing it. So this is Lydia. So they've put a name to it, rape. Amongst ourselves, we refer to it as the incident, as if it was a minor indiscretion, a misdemeanor, inconsequential and easily cleaned up. Rape is a messy word. It's loaded with dirty things, violence, hate, misogyny. It sits between us now like a landmine waiting to be triggered. Kevin is fidgeting. I want to slap him so hard that every nerve ending in my palm itches. He's incapable of playing it cool. Jesus, if he was ever in trouble, he'd confess straight away. He doesn't understand that this is a game that we have to carefully navigate. The winner is the one who doesn't give in, doesn't break. I won't respond. I won't be drawn into a discussion that involves that word, rapist. A rapist to me is some amorphous creature who lurks in entryways with soiled raincoat. It's not my son. A boy who brings me the odd cup of coffee without being asked, who slept with the landing light on till he was 13, who asked to sleep next to me when he was 12 because he had missed me when I was away for an overnight work trip. This boy who I've dedicated my life to, it's not what he is. I won't allow it. On the way over to the police station, Martin had talked us through what to expect. It's her word against his. That's what it comes down to. Oscar is a straight A, captain of the school rugby team, student. He's nothing to sully his record. His character is blemish free. All of that is in his favour. Kevin is nodding like this is stuff we don't already know. I want to hear the nitty gritty, like what physical evidence has been taken from the girl? Are there witnesses? Is her testimony consistent? This is the stuff that will make the difference if it goes all the way to a trial. We arrive at the station and I allow Martin to take control. This is what we are paying him for after all. My clients would like to have time with their son. He better be worth every penny. Of course, we're led down to a corridor, windows looking out onto a car park. Everything feels surreal. Time is no longer a known quantity. It felt like we'd been in that room for hours when in actual fact it's only been minutes. The policewoman opens the door and there he is, Oscar, my boy. He looks tired and scared. His eyes are wide and imploring, asking me to take him home, make it all better. Once when he was 3 years old, he fell in the garden, landed head first into a prickly shrub. He roared and cried while I undertook the delicate operation of removing each thorn with a pair of tweezers, his bottom lip quivering and his little face red and damp. Afterwards, I kissed every scratch mark until he was satisfied I'd made them all better. Now he looks at me with that same expression of expectation, hope that I can make this all go away. Kevin goes to him first, wraps his arms around him. They embrace like I've never seen them do. It's a full-on sobbing fest. Kevin lifts his head and looks to me to join them, opens up the embrace to make room for me, but my feet are planted firmly on the tiled floor. I can't move. I can't hug my son. So that's where I am. So I have lots of problems with it, but I'm working through it.
Such a huge undertaking, but really powerful in places. Like, you know, it's those kind of corners that people don't want to talk about.
Yeah, I think by telling the story from the point of view of the mothers was my way of sort of reclaiming the narrative almost, and fashion it into something else. But it feels like it's a minefield in many ways as well. And I don't want the mothers to end up being scapegoats for their sons' actions and their sons' violent actions. I want to do the genre honour by having, you know, the sense of disruption in their ordered lives. But, you know, I sort of, I don't know, it's just doing my head in at the minute, so sorry.
Do you know, one of the things I thought of when you were reading your extract there was something that I actually heard on Radio 4 just by chance the other day. And it was a radio play, and it was called The Christopher Boys Communion. And what that was about was, it was this mother, the character of the mother, and I'm afraid I can't remember all the details, but the character of the mother was the person who through whom all the action was taking place, but her son had been accused of murdering his girlfriend, and she was prepared to do whatever it took in order to get him off. And that included like talking to lawyers, and if the lawyers weren't in complete agreement that they were going to try and get him off as opposed to mitigating the punishment, she was, you know, straight away she was out there, she was like, I'm not interested, we're going to try and get him off, you know. And it was this single-minded like thing there, and it's not so much that that's what it reminded me of, it was more just that it was a character, it was through the character of the mother that this was taking place.
Yeah, and it's those sort of same themes that these mothers, I suppose, have really invested everything into these children. They've got this sense of middle class privilege, this idea that, you know, that they have invested time, money, effort and love, and these children will have these brilliant lives, even if it kills them to get it. But yet out of all of that comes this toxic masculinity, you know, and this sense that they can get away with anything. And, you know, it's trying to hold that up and look at that through a feminist lens rather than the lens of these are perpetrators of violent acts and they're going to be punished. So I almost want to see how the women deal with that and their character arc throughout the story then, you know. So will it, at the end, will they realise how wrong they've been and how they've brought these boys up, or am I blaming them because of society allowing that to happen? I don't know yet.
Yeah, I'm sure that the characters themselves would be aware that there is this societal pressure on them, and that any sort of feeling in their sons is somehow a reflection on their feelings. Even if that's not true, that they would certainly feel the pressure of that and the expectation of others. So that would be a really interesting dynamic to kind of look at.
Yeah, and I think it's an interesting perspective that hasn't been explored that much, and it's like this conflict, these conflicting kind of circles of you as a person, as a mother and as a woman, and it's like what happens when those two things clash.
Absolutely. And I think it's also the idea of their comfortable lives that they've worked really hard to create, you know, because sort of the backstory of these women, one of them came from a very working class background and feels she has clawed her way to this comfortable existence, you know, and it's not wanting that taken away as much as anything, but, you know, how far will they go to protect the sons and to protect themselves in some ways? You know, and then, you know, I also tell the story from the point of view of the victim, and to see then the case sort of played out on social media and the victim blaming that will go on, and how, again, all of that is linked back to class and privilege and misogyny. So it's all of those themes in the mix. But as I'm writing it, sometimes you just feel a bit, I don't know, not just uncomfortable with the material in some ways. You know, I don't want it to feel too caustic. I don't want it to feel like a satire, but at times it's verging on that, you know. And it's interesting to me because one of my first readers is a man, and there's a scene where one of the wives is really angry with the husband's sympathies for the victim, and she ends up throwing a wine glass with the wine in his face. And that male reader said that was too much. And I'm like, you're reading a book about rape and violence, mm-hmm. and a wine glass in somebody's face is too much, you know? Yeah. So it's just interesting, all of those little sort of dynamics, you know?
Yeah. It's a hefty topic. And maybe if you feel like it's virgin on satire, is like a way of you creating a bit of a self-defense against such, you know, violent and kind of harmful subject matter. How do you find you have to kind of guard yourself a little bit, because obviously it's very, you know, damaging to even think about those kinds of things?
Yes, to a degree that's very true. And I think the caustic satire that's there is probably almost excusing those women in a way, you know, and almost holding them up for ridicule rather than pity. You know, I want to blame them for their sons in some ways, but that's not right, you know. I don't want to blame other women for the way that men behave. So it's just interesting for me as a writer and a creative and as a woman really to be working with this type of material. The hard bit has been dealing with the research into rape cases and also seeing how that's played out in a trial, you know, and how damaging that is. So I'm wanting to make sure I do that justice. You know, at the end of the day, the women and the boys aren't really my main concern. It's the victim, Georgia, and how she navigates it all.
It also strikes me as well that, you know, of course you shouldn't blame the mother for what the sons have done, but that they can certainly take responsibility for how they act once they're faced with this information, you know, and how they act at that point, you know. So that's kind of an interesting way to take it.
I think that's where I will sort of be able to have some sort of resolution for me as a woman, that these women will then come to realize that yes, maybe they have in some ways facilitated almost bad behavior. Boys will be boys. That's what these boys have been brought up believing, and this whole rugby culture that's in their school, and just that self, you know, that privilege that's born out of that. And at the end of the day, my PhD is about interrogating class and gender in Northern Irish crime fiction. So you can see how this whole story and dynamic is, you know, fitting for that. There's plenty to be said and mined within that. So, yeah, just see how far I can take it and where I go with it as it develops. But, yeah, so it's good to be able to share that and have to talk through some of the issues, you know.
Yeah, I think it's such an interesting investigative tool, you know, to put, you're saying you don't want to blame these women. So, like, putting yourself into that mind frame of what, you know, what it would be like to be one of those women is like the ultimate kind of test of your empathy. Can you stretch your empathy that far to be in that person and feel those things, and what would they react in? And if you're investigating, you're like pushing your own kind of reaction.
Yeah, and like, your own sort of ethics and moral compass as well, you know how far would you go for someone you love? You know, that's sort of the bottom line. And would you be prepared to clear up their mess if they've done something horrendous to try to get them off, you know?
Yeah, and it's that kind of like clan mentality versus like societal mentality, and which one am I going to kind of take sides with?
Yeah, well, I think ultimately they will realize that the sons are totally wrong, and that, you know, they have to do something to mitigate that, and they will come good in the end, I hope. that remains to be seen. You know, maybe they're all just going to be so horrible that something dreadful happens to a lot of them.
Oh God.
It'll end up being a revenge story.
I can't wait to read it to find out.
Yeah.
So I think that's us wrapped up for today, and I've really enjoyed talking to you guys again. It's been so enlightening, and thank you for sharing your work. I really enjoyed that, and for letting me have the opportunity to share some of mine. And hopefully we'll be back again soon.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Sharon. Thanks, Steve.
You just heard The Edit with Sharon Dempsey, Niamh McCann and Emma Devlin. The Seamus Heaney Centre podcast is created in a small back room by Stephen Sexton and Rachel Brown. It was produced and featured original music by Connor McCafferty. With thanks, as always, to our guest writers and to our students for initiating this series of pilot programmes.